Tzoraim Tovim, good afternoon, everybody. Erev Tov for those in Israel. A pleasure to welcome everybody. A pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Yossi Levine, I think, who last spoke for us on Tisha B'Av, gave a wonderful shiur. Rabbi Levine, for those who don't know, is the senior rabbi at the Jewish Center in Manhattan on 86th Street, very, very prominent shul. He served as the rabbinic intern and then the associate rabbi and moved up the ranks. Is the senior rabbi, served under Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, who's now the president of Yeshiva University, which is a common career path for rabbis at the Jewish Center. So maybe one day, Rav Yossi, we'll look for you at the in the president's desk. Rabbi Levine received his smicha at Yeshiva University, and he also received a PhD at their Bernard Revville Graduate School, his PhD on the Chacham Tzvi. So maybe one day we'll have him give a shiur on the Chacham Tzvi. And he has a BA in English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He served as a Wexner Fellow, and is really one of the prominent rabbis in North America. And it's a pleasure to welcome him back and to give now for the first time a four-part series on Rav Yosef Karo and the making of the Shulchan Aruch, which today, over 400 years since it was written, closer to 500 years, it is still the standard code of Jewish law. So it must be a pretty amazing book. Rabbi Levine, Rabbi Dr. Levine, it's all yours. Bakasha.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. It's worth it to come just for the introduction. I could stop right here. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to learn with Torah in Motion. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to learn with each of you. And, you know, it's not an intimate group with this number of people. That being said, I always find that it's constructive when it's a collaborative effort. So to the extent that you have questions or comments that will move the conversation forward, please feel free to jump in. I'll try to pause every now and again to open things up to questions, and I'll try to check the chat also from time to time if there are questions or comments. So just to kind of lay out where we're headed in this four-part series, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, you know, the Shulchan Aruch is used by Jews around the world every day. It's become an authoritative code of Jewish law, if not the authoritative code of Jewish law. And the $64,000 question that I want to think about with you over the course of this series is how that happened. What makes this book, what makes this text so decisive and so authoritative? Who decided that we ought to follow the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch, and who gave this text so much weight that it wields so much influence in the sphere of Jewish law, in the sphere of halacha today, and you know, over the course of these 100 years. So this week we'll talk about the biography of Rav Yosef Karo to the extent that it can be known, and we'll talk about his magnum opus, which was not the Shulchan Aruch. It's a book called the Beit Yosef, or as we say in the yeshiva, Beis Yosef. That's surely not what he called it. But so forgive me if I sometimes call it the Beit Yosef and sometimes the Beis Yosef. We'll talk today about that that extraordinary book. Next week, we'll talk about and learn the Shulchan Aruch itself, and think and learn about how it was received. In our third section, we'll switch gears and talk about the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserlis, who plays a very important role in the course of this conversation. And in our final session, we'll try to tie things together and answer this looming question and make an argument about how the Shulchan Aruch got to be the Shulchan Aruch. So let me jump in and say a few words about the life and times of Rav Yosef Karo. It happens to be that there really is no authoritative biography that's been written about Rav Yosef Karo. If anybody is interested in a project, the world is waiting for an authoritative biography of Rav Yosef Karo. Part of the problem is that he's so prolific, and the reception history is so immense that the project becomes almost too tall an order for any one scholar to tackle. People have tried with varying degrees of success, but I say this just by way of introduction to excuse the gaps. We don't have a ton of information about Rabbi Yosef Karo's background, his training, his youth. We have just a few pieces, which I'm happy to share. And I say it tentatively because these facts, by and large, are known only tentatively. We don't know the birth date of Rabbi Yosef Karo. Scholars presume that he was born in or around 1488. And again, they presume that he was born in Spain. If he was born in Spain, then the working assumption is that in 1492, he left. I think when we think of 1492 and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, we make the assumption that all Jews left Spain. It's not actually accurate. Many Jews remained and trickled out of Spain over the succeeding decades and even centuries. But a not insignificant number of Jews left Spain in 1492, and they dispersed and they scattered and they went to everywhere you can imagine. So just picture the map of the Iberian Peninsula. So if you live in the north of Spain, you can head over the Pyrenees and travel to France. If you're in the south of Spain, maybe you travel to North Africa. Some Jews headed to parts of the Ottoman Empire, the Levant, Greece, present-day Greece, present-day Turkey. And there's this new diaspora created of Spanish Jewry. And I'll just say as a footnote, you know, we say Sephardic Jews colloquially to mean anyone who's like not Ashkenazim. But of course, this is wildly inaccurate. Sephardic Jews is a reference to Jews who come from Sfarad, who come from Spain. And as we may talk about today or in our next session, there was a great deal of conflict between the Jews of Spain and Jews of other communities. In North Africa, so there's North African traditions. In Greece, there are traditions of Greek Jews, and so on. They're not exactly the same. And the new immigrant populations often created conflict between and among their host communities. And we'll talk more about that in a few moments. Not a small number of Spanish Jews fleeing in 1492 found refuge in Portugal, but that refuge was very, very short-lived because Portuguese Jewry was expelled in 1497. So 1497, the family of Yosef Karo, and presumably he's just a child at this time, travels, and again, we don't know exactly where and when, but the seems like the bulk of the next decades in Rabbi Yosef Karo's life were spent in Turkey. He was in Cairo or in Egypt for a short time as well. We know that he receives full Talmudic training both from his father, a man called Rabbi Ephraim Karo, and he was also taught by his uncle, Rabbi Yitzchak Karo, who he quotes on a number of occasions. And he studied in Egypt under Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who we'll also circle back to in a few moments. In 1522, he's living in Andrianople, and then eventually in a place called Nicopolis, which is in present-day northern Bulgaria. In 1522, Rabbi Yosef Karo begins his work on the Beis Yosef, which is going to be the principal thing we talk about in a few moments. And in order to research and write that extraordinary book, Rabbi Yosef Karo needs access to books, and smaller Jewish communities have less access to books and to manuscripts, to Jewish texts. So we do know that Rabbi Yosef Karo also traveled to the libraries of Salonika and Constantinople, which were major metropolises as far as Jewish communities were concerned. And it was in those locations that he was able to find and identify some of the texts that would be important for his research in the writing of this book. 1536. In 1536, Rabbi Yosef Karo leaves Turkey, and spend some time, we think, in Egypt on his way to ultimately settling in Tzfat, in Safed, in Palestine, which is where he spends the rest of his life. I'll pause just to say something very brief about an important controversy that takes place in the 1530s in Safed. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about it next week, but just in the course of understanding of Yosef Karo's biography, it would be impossible to gloss over the Smicha controversy of the 1530s. There was a man called Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who was interested in recreating the notion of Smicha. Now, in 2023, somebody says, oh, I have smicha from this yeshiva, I'm a rabbi. So that's very nice. In the absence of Sanhedrin, that's kind of the best we can do. And a rabbi or group of rabbis can confer, quote unquote, smicha upon someone who has mastered a certain canon of material. But in the most formal and technical sense, smicha can only be bestowed by a Sanhedrin, it can only be musmachim, those who are ordained, who are able to create more musmachim. There was a kind of end around that Rabbi Yaakov Beirav tried to identify and recreate smicha with the intention of hopefully recreating a Sanhedrin for reasons that we won't get into right in this moment. The rabbis of Jerusalem, as opposed to the rabbis of Safed, were very opposed to this notion, but Rabbi Yosef Karo was totally on board with it. He actually received smicha and conferred it upon not a few of his students. At the end of this, story, which is again a much longer story, it never took. Nothing ever became of it, and no one ever claimed that they had kind of official smicha such that they could act on that basis. After Rabbi Yaakov Beirav leaves Safed in 1538, Rabbi Yosef Karo was seen as the leader of the Safed community. And just as a reminder, I'm sure most, if not all, of the people on this call have visited Tzfat. You know that 16th century Tzfat was a very important Jewish community filled with scholars and mystics. Okay, it's a hub of mystical learning and mystical teaching. Rabbi Yosef Karo is the head of this extraordinary group of extraordinary scholars who are learning and teaching at this time. I'll just say in parentheses, you know, prior to the 16th century, Safed did have, you know, a small Jewish community as a result of the Iberian expulsions. The community took off, and it was basically the 16th century that it was in its heyday. And for economic reasons, by the time you get to the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, the Safed community is much smaller, much less influential. But in the lifetime of Rabbi Yosef Karo, It is a central place of scholarship and learning for the Jewish people, and in many ways it surpasses even Jerusalem. Okay. So Rabbi Yosef Karo is considered to be the Gadol Hador, both locally and, let's even say, anachronistically, globally. So he receives questions and queries and letters from all over the Jewish world. Some of them are in search of halachic answers. Some of them are in search of political answers. And he becomes the address, the central address for Jewish scholarship the world over. He has approximately 200 students locally in Safed. And there's a kind of college of rabbis. They chew on, they talk about, they discuss, they interact with one another to think through important issues of the day. And we have records of many of these correspondences, someone would write to Rabbi Yosef Karo about a particular issue. He'd say, well, this is my opinion. I'll pass it on to my colleague and we'll ask for his opinion. And now that the two of us have given our opinion, we'll ask for a third opinion. And the issues would get generated. The answers would get generated in a very collaborative kinds of way. Rabbi Yosef Karo spends the rest of his life in Tzfat and passes away on March 24th, 1575. Again, if you've ever visited, you can visit his kever, you can visit his grave today, just as it could have been visited in 1575. We'll talk today primarily about the Beit Yosef and its influence and its importance in Jewish life. But let me say a word about the other text that Rabbi Yosef Karo authored in the course of his lifetime. One of the lesser known texts, which bears its own research and its own lecture, is a book called the Magid Meisharim. The Magid Meisharim is a mystical book. It's a mystical diary, and it records the conversations that Rabbi Yosef Karo had with a Magid. What is a Magid? It's hard for me to say because I have not met a Magid, but a Magid is a kind of a mystical voice, maybe an angelic voice, that appears to certain gifted individuals and shares with them wisdom or advice or Torah. And the Magid Meisharim is a journal of the conversations that that the Magid had with Rabbi Yosef Karo. So to give you an example, the Magid told Rabbi Yosef Karo that he should study Mishnah very diligently. Don't just think about Torah and Talmud. Also study Mishnah. The Magid had appeared to Rabbi Yosef Karo and said, you should move to the land of Israel, which Rabbi Yosef Karo did. The Magid predicted that Rabbi Yosef Karo would become a preeminent leader of world Jewry. The Magid gave ethical instruction to Rabbi Yosef Karo. He gave him Kabbalistic explanations of the spheros and Maaseh Bereshis, he shared with him mystical reflections on issues such as reincarnation, the resurrection of the dead, miracles, divine providence, free choice, dream interpretation, the kavanos behind eating, why mystical intentions matter when it comes to the performance of mitzvos, and so on. I mention this because it's a fascinating and important work, but also to just kind of remind us that sometimes I think we get an image of Yosef Karo as a legalist and the author of a legal code. And so he must have been this totally dispassionate rationalist, when in fact, in addition to being a rational thinker and a logical thinker and an organized thinker and a compiler of Jewish law, he was also a mystic. And so there's a whole second side and a second component to this man's personality, which should just be noted and remembered when we think about the kinds of biographical complexity of Rabbi Yosef Karo. One of the other works that he authored and actually published during his lifetime is the Magid Mishnah, and the Magid Mishnah is a commentary on the Rambam. The Rambam held a very special place in the mind and the heart of Rabbi Yosef Karo. I'm sorry, I said the Magid Mishnah. I meant to say the Kesef Mishnah. The Magid Mishnah was already had already been written well before. The Kesef Mishnah is Rabbi Yosef Karo's commentary to the Mishnah Torah by the Rambam. And in his introduction, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes that his goal was to provide the sources for the Rambam's rulings. If you ever opened up the Mishnah Torah, so it's abbreviated and condensed and sourceless. 99.9% of the time, the Rambam tells you the halacha, he tells you the law, he tells you what to do, without citing the basis for that decision, for that conclusion. So Rabbi Yosef Karo comes along and says, I want to tell you where that comes from. There's a debate in the Gemara, and the Rambam has decided that, and he gives you the and he gives you the sources. And in his introduction to the Kesef Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo also writes that it was his intent to defend the Rambam against the critiques and criticisms of the Raibid, who had sometimes withering attacks on the decisions of the Rambam. There were other works that Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote during his lifetime that were not published until after his lifetime, including his drashos, his speeches, his sermons, and a book of Shailos and Tshuvos, a book of his responsa. It actually wasn't published. Remember I said Rabbi Yosef Karo dies in 1575. His responsa are not published. They exist only in manuscript form until 1791, which is really extraordinary. But those Shailos and Tshuvos also provide a fascinating window onto kind of contemporary life and issues that Rabbi Yosef Karo was dealing with. Questioners, querists would write to him and ask for halachic advice, and we have the record of Rabbi Yosef Karo's responses. Okay, now I want to turn to the Beis Yosef. Before I do, maybe I'll just pause here for a moment and ask if there are any pressing questions or comments. Okay, so in that case. Let me invite you to turn to the source sheet for just a moment. I'll pull it up on the screen from time to time. But let me say a few words about this book that we're going to crack open and try to wrestle with in the time that we have remaining. So, as I mentioned, Rabbi Yosef Karo begins writing the Beis Yosef in 1522 when he's in the city of Andrianople. He completes the text in 1542 when he's already ensconced in Safed, and he finally publishes it from beginning in 1550 through that decade from 1550 to 1559. So, 20 years to write, and let's say, you know, between if any of you on this call are authors, so you know that it takes some time and effort to get the book from manuscript to the printed form, but you wouldn't expect that it would take 8 years. So he was still doing editing and revising over the course of this time, and if you count 1522 to 1550, it's a 28-year project. Okay, just imagine anything that you spend 28 years on in your life. It's a lifetime work. It is his magnum opus. And as we'll see in a few moments, it is just a work of staggering, staggering scholarship. Okay. It would be hard to imagine. It would be hard to imagine another, another book that that is its equal as far as its breadth and its depth are concerned. I'll just share with you one quote about Rabbi Yosef Karo's Beis Yosef from the rabbi and historian Moses Gaster, and you have it here on your in your source sheet as source number one. Gaster wrote the following. He says, it was left, however, to Rabbi Yosef Karo to master all that had been written before him and to apply that vast, unrivaled learning to the explanation of the Torah, which we'll talk about in a second. In commenting on each section, he laid bare the whole history of each prescription, marshaled all the authorities, expounded and set forth all the views, and finally, after sifting that material, after weighing argument against argument, he arrived at settled conclusions. Each work that was written before his time, each compilation that was made by his predecessors was a block of marble, which he used for the monumental edifice known as the Beit Yosef, the exhaustive commentary to the Torah. Okay. And I think that's quite well said. And we'll see why. And we'll see why in a moment. Okay. So let me say a word about the landscape of Jewish law and halacha before I study with you the introduction to the Beit Yosef, which is going to take up the bulk of what I want to share with you today. Remember that print is invented in the 15th century. So we're now, let's say, 100 years into the print revolution, and we're still at the infancy. Books are being printed. There's not necessarily a ton of quality control. The most important controlling factor is economics. It costs a lot of money to print a book, but anyone who can afford it can print a book, and it may be a great book. It may be a less than great book. It may be a comprehensive book. It may be a less than comprehensive book. And the world is sorting itself out, and the Jewish world is sorting itself out as far as coming to grips with how to use this relatively new technology and what it will mean for the study and practice of Jewish law. Okay. So there are codes. A code of Jewish law means that there's some kind of digest. If you assume that the Talmud is the decisive body of Jewish law, so that's wonderful, but the Talmud is a very long text and it's a complicated text. And sometimes we have debates. Often we have debates. Sometimes they're unresolved. And if you want to know what bracha to make after you've had a meal of you know, rice and beans, so it's hard to know where to find the answer to that question if all you have is the Talmud. So, of course, you have Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, and Maimonides' Mishneh Torah is an extraordinary, extraordinary work and life-altering work for anyone interested in halachic scholarship and halachic practice. But as I mentioned a moment ago, it doesn't come with sources, and it is unilateral. The Rambam isn't telling you, oh, there's a particular debate, and he just says, the way it is. When it comes to the when it comes to the Ashkenazim, we have the Tur, which is written by Rabbi Yaakov Bal HaTurim, and that is a that's a medieval text which is very prominent among Ashkenazim, but much less so among Sephardim, and the Tur has its own shortcomings. So Rabbi Yosef Karo comes along and decides that he is going to append his book. And I'm reluctant to call it a commentary, and you'll see why in a moment, to append his book to the text of the Torah. So he retains the order of the Torah. He retains the structure of the Torah. And he says, I'm going to cast my lot with the Torah and add this 28-year-long project to the Torah. Again, this is not the Shulchan Aruch. We're going to talk about the Shulchan Aruch next week, which is a different kind of book. The Beis Yosef is an expansive, truly expansive book. So let's look at the introduction, and let's just a word of caution. You know, whenever you read the introduction of a book, so you're getting the kind of mission statement of the author. You have to always go back and test out whether and to what extent you have to go back and test out whether and to what extent the author actually makes good on the promises he makes in his introduction. Does he do what he sets out to do and how successful? So let's jump now. If you have the source sheet in front of you, and I'll post it on the screen, let's jump to the introduction of the Beis Yosef, of Rabbi Yosef Karo. I can't share with you the introduction in its entirety because it's a little long, but I want to share a number of important highlights And then in the time that we have remaining, I want to study with you just a few excerpts from the Beis Yosef so we can actually see how the work functions in action. And again, time permitting, I have four excerpts that I want to study with. So what's the goal? What's the idea behind this, the production, the authorship of this book, which really was the life project of Rabbi Yosef Karo? So if you look at the bold in source number two, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes, writes the following. He says, So he makes two important introductory comments. One, he says, is we're scattered and we are dispersed, and it's a problem. And this moment calls for some kind of order and some kind of reclamation of the halachic system. We need to know how to operate in this decentralized world where the largest community in the entirety of the world, Spanish Jewry, was exiled and just like that, ended up scattered throughout the Jewish world. Problem number one is that we've been dispersed. Problem number two is the problem of print, right? Print is a blessing, but print can also be a curse. So Rabbi Yosef Karo says, everybody's writing books, and who knows whether or not they're any good, and who knows whether or not anyone should follow them. He continues, "Vegam ki hema mei haaretz kamen asam haisala ir." Michashkenu nimshach lanu mitoch haor hatov shenahaninu mehem amei haaretz safek umavucha rabba b'yos kol echad mechaber sefer le'atzmo v'kofel mashikfar kasav v'chiber mashikadmu o kosef adin behepech mashikasvo chaveru below yaskir dvarav. So he says, it's not just that Torah is divided and now there are two schools of thought. There's like 100 schools of thought. Everybody writes his own book. They don't cite each other. You just say what you think is right, which might be the exact opposite of what someone else has written. Someone will just write that this is the halacha as if, oh yeah, that's been accepted by everyone. When in fact, you'll discover that it's actually part of a huge controversy and not everyone agrees. And there's a whole other side which never got mentioned in the book. This happens all the time. I can't even tell you how big a scourge this is. It's happening right and left, and something needs to be done. I'll just say parenthetically, with the exception of print, which is a new revolution, the notion that we're dispersed and we're scattered and we have no centralized authority, so that's not a new phenomenon. That has happened, since the destruction of the temple in 70. That's going on all the time, and there's always a need to kind of make this negotiation and sort things through and figure out, okay, this is what we used to do, but things changed. Now what do we do? The piece that got exacerbated in this moment, which I alluded to a few moments ago, is the conflict between home communities, host communities, and the exiles. So it's one thing where you have a group of 100 Jews living in a particular community and a new family moves into the community. So you absorb them and they recognize that, okay, I'm not in Kansas anymore. I'm going to practice whatever the community does. But if you're a community of 100 Jews and now a community of 500 exiles shows up in your community and say, the new immigrants say, well, we don't do things that way. We have our own. That creates tension. That creates machlokes, and that has to get sorted through. Okay. The Reb Yosef continues. Reb Yosef Karo says again what I alluded to just a moment ago, and that is, you know, you could open up the Talmud. We all know the halacha comes from the Talmud, but it's not always easy to find answers just based on the Talmud. Halachos are scattered in different places. Unless you're a baki b'chol hashas, unless you really know the Talmud backwards and forwards, it's going to be very hard to just base your practical religious life on the Talmud. Again, something needs to be done. He mentions in passing that, you know, people have tried and they write these kitzer svarim, you know, the little pamphlet, 50 pages. These are the halachos of shchita. 30 pages. These are the halachos of malicha, whatever the case may be. And he says, this is not effective. There's no quality control. There's a lot of problems with these books. We need a solution. So he says, let me tell you how I came to the conclusion to write my book as a commentary, as an appendage to the tour. So he says, originally, you know, I thought that I would write a commentary on the Rambam. Okay. He says, v'lachein, this is the bold in this paragraph that begins with the words alkein. He says, "V'lachein hiskamti l'samchu l'achad me'aposkim meforsamim." What I wanted to do was attach, you know, hitch my wagon to one of the great poskim of the generations. "V'ala b'dati l'samchu l'sefer Rambam zal liyoso aposek hayosem meforsam b'olam." Nobody bigger than the Rambam. So I thought, okay, I'm going to hitch my wagon to the Rambam. V'chazarti bi, and then I changed my mind. Why? The problem with the Rambam is too concise. He only gives you his conclusion. There's no reference to minority opinion, to the controversy, to a debate, to machlokes. So he says the work I would have to do to fill in all the gaps, if I started with the Rambam, would just be too much, and I didn't want to do that. So he says, what I did, v'lachein, hiskamti l'samchu l'sefer arba tzurim shechiba harav Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Harash zal, ki hu kolel rov deos haposkim. So I decided that I'm going to hitch my wagon to the tour. Why? Not because the tour is the biggest or the best, or the most important, but because the tour has an advantage that the Rambam doesn't have. The tour, as a general matter, gives you multiple opinions. So the Beis Yosef says, now I have something to work with, right? I don't have to educate the reader about everything that's not in the text. The tour has at least given you multiple valences of a particular, multiple dimensions of a particular sugya, and it's a meatier text with which to work, and that's why I decided to write this book as an appendage to the tour. He says, I'm going to give you the background, I'm going to give you the sources, I'm going to fill in the gaps. You need to know what the Talmud says, and you need to know what everyone since the Talmud says. Now, this is an amazing paragraph. The Beis Yosef says, let me just tell you how I function. What I did is a research project. Obviously, I had to know all of Shas. But in addition to all of Shas and all of the major poskim, he says, what I also did was I worked through the following sources. Listen to this list. The paragraph beginning with the word nimtza in the bold. Nimtza shemishi yes sefer zeh lefanav. If you have my book in front of you, you know what you'll have? Yusidurim lefanav drivri ha-talmud in perosh Rashi ve-Tosfos. You'll have the Gemara with Rashi and Tosfos, and in addition, you'll have the following. Haran, Piska Rif, Ve'arash, Ve'amordechai, Ve'arambam, Ve'hagosav, Ve'magin Mishma, Ve'rbein Yerucham, Ve'sefer HaTruma, Shili Bali HaLeket, Ve'rokeach, Ve'sharidura, Ve'sefer HaTashbeitz, Ve'sefer HaItzer, Ve'nemuki Yosef, Ve'smag, Ve'smak, Ve'orchas Chaim, Ve'taras HaBayis, Ve'agos HaShri, Ve'sefer HaManing, Ve'agor, Ve'sefer Bali HaNefesh, La'arayvid, Ve'chubas HaRash, Ve'arashba, Ve'ari Bar Sheshes, the Rivash, Ve'arbeinu Shimshon, Bar Tzemach, the Rashbats, Umari, Kolon, the Maharit, the Truma Sadesh, and Kol Divrei Muvar Nitev, Vitas Makamos, Mamre HaZohar. 32 sources, including sometimes the Zohar. So what you have here is staggering. It is extraordinary, because it means not is he only going to cite or reference these books in the course of his commentary, he's going to cite, reference, sift through, and synthesize all of these books. And it's not even a complete list. There are others in addition. So what you have here is the entire corpus of Jewish legal writing from the Talmud until 1522. And he takes it all, masters it all, and synthesizes it all. Okay. And this is part of the reason why I say the Beis Yosef is such an extraordinary work. Sometimes you have someone who's a genius and they're a great researcher and they can find all this information and they can report on all the information. And sometimes you have someone who's a genius and they're a philosopher and a thinker. And if you give them three sources, they'll synthesize them and they'll come up with a fascinating comment, observation, or argument. The Beis Yosef does both. It's the breadth and the depth, right? At such an unprecedented level, right, that we've not seen before or since a work like the Beis Yosef. A work of almost unending ambition, and he actually pulls it off. Now, perhaps the most famous part of the Beis Yosef's introduction is the rule that he lays out as a means by which to arrive at a conclusion. So he has this panoply of sources before him. He has all of Shas, the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi and Rashi and Tosos and every commentary and every poseg between the close of the Talmud and 1522. So he says, so what's the rule? What's the rule of thumb? At the end of the day, I want people to know what to do. What happens when you forget Yalev Yavo on Rosh Chodesh? Just lemaisa, right? Just tell me what I'm supposed to do. I have all the sources, I have all the sukkah. I also need a conclusion to the discussion. So he says in paragraph V'lachein hiskamti b'dati ki liyoshloshes amudei ha'ora asher ha'bayis beis Yisrael nishan aleihem b'horoseihem halohem ha'rifa Rambam b'Rashzal amarti libi shemakom sheshnayim mehem askinim l'das achas nifsok halacha kemosan. Now, the Beis Yosef didn't make up this rule. Sometimes people had used it in the past, but he used it in a methodological way that was unprecedented and made this the governing principle for his entire book. What's the rule? The rule is, he says, at the end of the day, the three most prominent, three most important poskim are the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. And if all three comment on a particular issue and there's ever debate, majority rules. Okay? The same way that a Beis Din with three judges would rule in favor of the majority of three, two out of three is good enough. That's how I'm organizing my book. And if ever there's a debate between or among the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush, as long as I have two out of three, that's going to be the conclusion. If one of them is silent and it's a tie, he says, well, then I have a second tier of poskim and even a third tier of poskim. And there's the system to work through what happens if there's not a simple majority between and among the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. But if there is, then that is going to be dispositive, and that is going to be decisive. And again, that is revolutionary. The notion that from among this whole constellation of poskim, we could choose the three biggest and decide based on a simple majority of two out of the three, that is revolutionary. He writes at the end, just to wrap things up, the conclusion to his introduction, he says, Nimtza shesefer zeh, Nimtza, the bold in the last paragraph of source number two, Nimtza shesefer zeh mazon l'kula bay. This book is going to be a kind of sustenance, not in a literal sense, but in a spiritual or figurative sense. This book is going to be the the source of sustenance for everyone who uses it. Alkein Karasiv Beis Yosef. That's why I called it Beis Yosef. His name is Yosef. And why is it the house of Yosef? I'll tell you why, he says. Ki kishem shemi Beis Yosef ha-yunizonim ha-kol mazon ha-guf. Kach yunizonim yisefer ze mazon ha-nefesh. He says, Joseph, the biblical Joseph, provided actual sustenance for everyone who came to him. It was his home, Beis Yosef, that provided food for everyone who came to Egypt at a time of famine. He says, I'm going to do the same thing for everyone who comes looking for spiritual sustenance in this time of spiritual famine. The ode, Tam Sheni, ki ze chalki mikol mali, v'hu beisi ba'olam hazeh u'ba'olam haba. And this is like my home. Because I devoted so much time and so much energy into this this project, this is going to be the place where I'm able to be identified, both in this world and, please God, in the next. Okay. With this in mind, and I hope this provides some context and background for what the Beis Yosef is trying to do in his book, let's see it now in practice. And again, time permitting, I have four excerpts from the Beis Yosef, which I hope will be illuminating and will provide, you know, a little meat on the bone so we can see not just the mechanism, but actually in action what the Beis Yosef is doing in his book. I picked examples. We're here in the time period between Hanukkah and Purim. So I picked a couple examples from these holidays, areas that that are known to us so that we could just jump right in rather than, you know, something which might be more complex or required more background topics that are less well known. So as you know, the tour tells us the story of Hanukkah at the beginning of his Hilchos Hanukkah, and he writes in source number three, my Hanukkah detanya b'chafei b'kislev yom Hanukkah timnaya inun delola nisped b'hon delola migzar b'hon tainis. You have these 8 days of Hanukkah, which begin on the 25th of Kislev, and they're special days. We don't eulogize on them, and we don't fast on them. Why? Because of this story of the Chashmonaim and the temple and the restoration of the temple and the miracle of the oil. We know the story. Beis Yosef jumps in source number four, and he writes the following, says, V'ikil medak, lama kabu shmona yamim? Famous question of the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef says, I don't understand. Why did the sages decree a holiday in duration of 8 days? Why an 8-day holiday? The cave and the shemen shebapacha yibok yivei lahadik laila achas v'nim tza shalun asanes ela b'shiva leilos. He says, just do the math. Right. What's the story that the Torah just quoted? We all know the story. The story was they looked high and low, and all they could find was one cruse of oil. It was enough oil for one day, right, to illuminate the menorah for one night. So what happened? Where'd the 8 days come from? Miraculously, the oil lasted for 8 days, which means that there were seven miraculous days of this miracle. The first day wasn't a miracle. The first day you had the oil. What happened on days 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? That's the miracle. So it's a 7-day miracle. It should be a 7-day holiday. What a great question. The Torah never mentioned it. The Torah never alluded to it. So along comes the Beis Yosef, and he says, I'm going to fill in the gap, right? And this is not a halachic question. This is a kind of philosophical question. Let me explain to my reader. You're just a good practicing Jew trying to know how to observe Hanukkah. And the Beis Yosef says, you're going to walk around with a misconception thinking that the oil lasted for 8 days, an 8-day miracle. It's not an 8-day miracle. It's a 7-day miracle. So what's the miracle? Why 8 days? So he says, I'll give you a couple answers. V'yesh lomar, shechilku shemen shebapach l'shmona chalakim. So he says, one possibility is, that what happened is they had 1 day's worth of oil, but what they did is they thought, okay, it's going to take us 8 days to get new oil. What we'll do is we'll use 1/8 of the oil each day. So each night they put in 1/8 of the oil. By a dolek araboker, it was only supposed to last, let's just say, for ease of argument, the night was 8 hours long. It was supposed to last for an hour. That's how much fuel there was, but it lasted for 8 hours. and it went through the whole night, and then it has the same thing happened. And the same thing happened on day two, and then again on day three. And so he says, in that way, there was a miracle that happened on each day for 8 days. And so it's an 8 day holiday. Alternatively, Odi Shlomer, Shalacha Shanas Nushen and Veneros Hamanora, Kishir Nishar Apach, Malay Kabatzchila, Venikar Nes Afbalela Rishon. Or what might have happened is they put all of the oil in on the first night and it burned throughout the night. And then they got there and they're going to relight it. And lo and behold, the whole oil, the whole amount of oil was still there. It didn't get consumed, in which case the first day was miraculous too. So I share this with you as a means by just to point out, in addition to all the work I just mentioned about reading and researching and synthesizing all of the sources that he organized and synthesized, he also contributes, right, his own chidushim and his own novel explanations to help make the tour more readable and to give the reader of his book a broader explanation and broader appreciation for whatever sugya he's learning and teaching about. Example number two, source number five. In passing, the Tur writes, you know, the mitzvah of Chanukah is to light a menorah in your home, and you should light it by the entrance. But when you light the menorah in shul, in the Beit HaKnesset, ubeBeit HaKnesset manicha ledarom zech lemenorah shehaitza bedarom. But when you light it in the shul, you should light it in the south of the shul, because the temple's menorah, the menorah in temple time, stood in the against the southern wall of the temple. So the Beis Yosef comes along, and in the interest of time, maybe I'll just summarize source number six. Or maybe just look at a couple of highlights. So he wonders, like, what is this about? Right? At the end of the day, the mitzvah is to light a Chanukah menorah in your home. Why are you lighting it in shul? And so he provides a research essay on shul menorah lighting. And you'd never have any clue about this if you only had the tour. So the Beis Yosef comes, and he gives you these sources, some of which may be known to scholars, but they wouldn't be known to any of us. So just to take you through it quickly, he says, well, let me just start by telling you, based on a kalbo, wasn't even on his list of 32, let me just tell you that, you know, this is parallel to the minhag that we have to make kiddush and shul on Friday night. Why are you making kiddush? People aren't eating in shul on Friday. He says, yeah, but there's always some visitors, some guests. They might not have a place. They might not have a home. The shul becomes their home. So the same way they make kiddush for them on Friday night, like Hanukkah candles for them on Hanukkah, maybe they're not going home because they're traveling, the visitors, maybe they don't have a home. There's always going to be somebody in shul who's not lighting at home, light candles for them. Because of Otam Acher Shehu Kidei Lefar Samanes Bifnei Kol Ha'am Ulesader HaBrachos Lifneihem Sheyesh Bazeh Pirsum Gadol Hashem Yisparach V'Kidush Shmo. Shul is also a great place. If you boil down the mitzvah of Chanukah, it's a mitzvah of Pirsum Anes. You want to publicize the miracle. You could publicize the miracle to people who might live in your neighborhood, but there's no better place to publicize the miracle than a place of public gathering. So we light candles in the shul. And then he goes on and he says, and we didn't even think of this question, but on what basis can you say a bracha on a candle that you're lighting in shul? Right? That's not anybody's mitzvah. I'm going to go home and light candles in 10 minutes right after davening. So how could I make a bracha in shul? That's not my mitzvah. My mitzvah's at home. He says, no, I'll tell you, I have a tshuva from the Rivash who addressed this question. He says, it's a very old minhag. Don't disparage it. You should take it seriously. He says, it's compensatory. You know, the best way to fulfill the mitzvah of Neiros Chanukah is to light outside your house. And that would be really public. You know, anti-Semitism, it's problems politically to do that. So we light inside in our homes. But we'd really love to be doing something more public. So the Rav Ash says the substitute for the public lighting that you're not doing outside your home will do inside the shul. And for that reason, you're allowed to make a brach. Fascinating. And again, we'd never know. You're going to go find that Shubas HaRivash buried in a manuscript. I don't even know if it's been printed, right? So this is extraordinary that the Beis Yosef is able to bring to bear, right, all the relevant sources on a pretty important question that we would otherwise have no knowledge of if we were just reading the Rambam or, for that matter, the Torah. Two final excerpts before we conclude. Purim is just a little over a month away, so it's good to think about Purim. In source number seven, the Torah writes the following. You know, one of the four mitzvahs that you have to do on Purim is called Matanos La'evyonim. You have to give money to an indigent person. And in the course of writing about that mitzvah, I don't know if we paid too much attention to this, but the Torah writes, Ve'ena ani reshai lahotziacha, Lidzavar acher, ella besudas purim. If you write a check or you hand a $50 bill to an indigent person on Purim, so there's halachos that are attached to that gift. The Torah says the ani, that indigent person, is allowed to use that fund exclusively to provide for his sudas purim, for the festive meal that he's going to eat on Purim. He can't say, "Ah, oh, thank you so much. The one I'll use $10 and I'll save for." No, it has to be used on Purim. Okay, and it comes from a Gemara in source number 8, which again you could see from Bav Metzia. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, Omer Mishum ben Meir, have a position of Ben Meir, Hanosen Dinar La'ani Likach Lo Chaluk, Lo Yikach Bo Talis. If you gave him money to buy a shirt, it's supposed to be used for buying a shirt and not for buying something else. Talis Lo Yikach Bo Chaluk, you can't change it. Mineshe Mavri Al Daito Shel Baal Abayis. If it's given with specific intent, so the recipient is not allowed to change that intent. In source number 9, which I'll just summarize, the Beis Yosef jumps on this and he says, who said? I disagree, right? That Gemara was never meant to be conclusive. That was never considered decisive. And in fact, if the recipient of that gift wants to use that fund for something else. He certainly could, and I'll tell you why. And he takes you back, and he says, this is what the Rush says, and this is what the Rif says, and this is what the Rambam says. If you go back to my three pillars, which the Torah ignored, you'd know that two of them are on my side and give permission for the indigent recipient of the gift to use the funds as he or she sees fit. Final example before we run out of time. The Torah writes in source number 10, Mitzvah laharbos besudas purim mitzarach shishtaker ad shel yada ben aru haman lebaruch Mordechai. So there's a mitzvah in Purim to drink. You have to have a suda, and in the course of the suda, you should drink something. How much should you drink? You should drink enough to be able to lose track of the distinction between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai, the blessed Mordechai, and accursed Haman. And the Beis Yosef decides selectively in source number 11, Kasuv Be'orchas Chayim Chayiv Inish L'Besunim B'Puria. There's a mitzvah to drink on Purim. Lo Shishtaker Shashichrus Isser Gamo. He says, you're not supposed to drink. Don't be confused by this and think that when the Torah says you're supposed to drink, it means you should drink such that you become drunk. No, that is an absolute prohibition. And he quotes this Orchos Chaim, which puts it in a very extreme terms. He says there's no greater sin than drunkenness. He says, who knows what happens when you're drunk? You can do all kinds of regrettable things. Don't do that. If you normally drink a little, you should drink a drop more than you normally drink. That's the obligation. Never should you imagine the Beis Yosef writes. Never should you imagine that you should become drunk on Purim. Right. So again, because he has all of these sources at his fingertips, he's able to cite one that recasts the halacha in a totally different light and gives the reader a little mussar in the process. I'll just say in our last 60 seconds that I hope some of this gives us an appreciation for just how extraordinary a work the Beis Yosef is. Rabbi Yosef Karo considered it his magnum opus, and for good reason. The breadth, the depth, and the virtuosity are just extraordinary, and it covers the entirety of the halachic canon as it's practiced in the post-temple period. You could look up anything in Jewish practice, and you'll get an essay from the Beis Yosef about every possible angle that one could think of on the topic, organized and synthesized. I hope today's session provides a taste of what this remarkable book is all about, and please God, next week we'll pick up with discussion of the Shulchan Aruch continue from there in our third week with the discussion of the Rambam. So it's 2 o'clock. I'm going to stop here, but I'm more than happy to stay on and take questions. And I see a number of comments in the chat, which I'm happy to try to address.
Thank you very much.
Hi. Can I? I'm listening from the UK, from Manchester, UK. And interestingly, our rabbi has just started doing something similar in for women, but from a different angle. And it's very, very useful. I used to teach Jewish history. I'm finding this really, really interesting. I think you're brilliant. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Flattery will get you everywhere.
Going through the chat. I think you should go through the chat first before accepting other questions.
Sure. Happy to. So Portuguese Jews were exiled in 1497. It was the same story, you know, throughout the Iberian Peninsula. So Spanish Jews, 1492, Portuguese Jews, 1497. Again, not all of them leave in that moment. Some of them stay as secret Jews, crypto Jews. Some of them convert to Christianity and so on. Someone said published. When was printing invented? How accessible was it in his lifetime? So that's a great question. So you have printing already the second half of the 15th century. In Incunabula is the word that we use to describe the early infancy stages of Jewish printing. Many of the books that the Beis Yosef mentions are actually books by the beginning of the 16th century, but some are not. And I'll just say an important historical comment, which is often underappreciated, and that is the print revolution does not end the creation of manuscripts. So for hundreds of years, even while books are being printed, nonetheless, you have other texts that are continuing to circulate in manuscript for various reasons. Okay. Continuing here in the chat, we'll just pick up a few more questions. What about the Rif? So I think probably by the time that was posted, so we did get to the Rif. Maybe the question was why didn't the Beis Yosef attach his commentary to the Rif? So the Rif is a different kind of work, which really requires the Talmudic background. So it's less of a code and more of a conclusion to the Talmud. The Jews were dispersed for almost 1500 years by this time. Yes, that is certainly true. And he did mean the Spanish expulsion. Okay. As a teenager in the 1960s, okay, the approach to women. So that's a big topic. I'll say as a general rule, there's not anything novel about women in the Beis Yosef or the Shulchan Aruch, which is to say, it's predominantly a compilation and synthesis of earlier sources. So to the extent that there's an issue that comes up in the Talmud or the Rambam about women, it'll be echoed or maybe amplified in the Shulchan Aruch, but obviously part of a larger discussion. Okay. Okay, if he goes according to all those three, why does he need all 33 as he mentioned before? So that's a great question. So part of the answer has to do with being comprehensive, and he wants you to know not just the conclusion but the background. So the 33 will fill in, or 32 as the case may be, will fill in the context of the particular sugya, of the particular issue. And then the goal is to get to a conclusion, and the conclusion will be based on the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. That's funny. At the end, Joseph enslaved all the Pharaoh, as many are slaves to the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, that's a funny comment. I wouldn't say quite slaves. We'll talk about the Shulchan Aruch next week, but certainly a lot of people are dependent on the Shulchan Aruch the way they were dependent on Yosef. Okay. Great point. Rif, Rambam, Rush, two Sephardim and one Ashkenazi, and we're going to address that when we talk about the Ramah. Because we're going to talk more about this over the next 2 weeks, the Shulchan Aruch and the Beis Yosef, the works of the Rabbi Yosef Karo, do skew Sephardic, right? And not unintentionally. So there's a corrective, and we'll talk about that when we talk about Ramosha Isserles. In future weeks, we possibly could enlarge the text. Happy to enlarge the text as much as possible. And just as a reminder, the text should have come to you in the email, so you should be able to manipulate it any way you like. And it's posted in the chat. So again, if it's too small on my screen, you should be able to access it on your own. Okay, any other questions here? It's fair to say the combination of halacha mitzvahs and the basis of embodying this person's writing is rare today, and if so, why? So great question. We'll talk a little bit more about the Zohar and its inclusion in the Shulchan Aruch next time. I'll just make one kind of comment writ large, and that is, Kabbalah in the life and context of the Shulchan Aruch, the life in the context of Rabbi Yosef Karo, what was everywhere, right? Imagine if you lived in Sfat in the 16th century. It's in the air. Right? It's what people are talking about. It's what people are living and breathing. And our world is a little bit of a different world. It's obviously a big question, but yes, this combination of people who are able to combine rationalism and mysticism is indeed rare, and I think it also speaks to the unique quality of Rabbi Yosef Karo and part of what makes him stand out. Well, we found a way to take advantage of printing it, still keep the ritual safe for Torah in manuscript form. Islam did not allow the Quran to be printed in the 20th century. I was not aware of that. That's fascinating. Okay, I think that covers it from the chat. I'm more than happy to take any questions from the listening audience.
What was the relative populations of the Sephardim and Ashkenazim in Karo's time? He based more on the Sephardim than the Ashkenazim. What were the population sizes?
It's a great question. I'm not sure if we know the answer to that question. In Safed, the Sephardim are certainly predominant.
Do you think that by choosing Rif as one of his three decisors, Karo lent too heavily towards Rambam, because Rif nearly always follows Rambam, nearly always follows Rif?
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's important point. It's probably true, meaning at the end of the day, Rabbi Yosef Karo, really felt that the Rambam was the center of the halachic world, and it, I guess in a certain way, using the Rif amplified that conviction.
Thank you.
In the same direction. Wasn't the Rosh greatly influenced by the Ramban, which would be the way in which a lot of Kabbalah came into the halacha?
Yeah, yeah. So I'll put it a little differently and say that, you know, the Rush, if you're looking at these three giants, and you say, well, there's two Sfaradim and one Ashkenazim, it's even worse than that. Because the one Ashkenazic posek that he's chosen spent half his life in Spain. Okay, the Rush actually had fled Ashkenaz and ended up in Spain and was totally immersed and conversant in Spanish in Sephardic halacha, and so. You know, it's a little like Rabbi Yosef Karo's thumb is on the scale, tipping things toward the Sephardic world. But we'll talk more next week, quite explicitly, about what his goals are and how he tried to be a voice of authority, not only for the Sephardim but also for the Ashkenazim.
How much was the Sefer Beit Yosef accepted besides by the people who were wowed by his breadth of 32 of all of these scholars? Like somebody who just didn't know the halacha, did they care about him so much, or did they say, "Well, my mother did it this way, I'll continue to do it this way"?
So that's a great question, and we'll really talk about that in the context of the reception history of the Shulchan Aruch next week. The short answer is, it's a mixed bag. You have people who said right away, you know, wow, this is amazing. Forget all the rest. And you had people who said, this is interesting, but, you know, I have my, tradition and I have my Rebbe and I have my library. And so, you know, as you just articulated.
When Karo was writing this, did he write it linearly, or did he have all four Turim out there and kept on adding to each one, building them up, and, you know, as he went along and knew more?
Great, great question. I'm not, I certainly don't know the answer, and I'm pretty sure the answer is not known.
Do you think, was the credibility of Karo ever questioned because of his alleged influence of the Maggid? Were there authorities who said, how can we trust a Gadol if he claims to have angelic sources?
So the amazing thing is, not to my knowledge, I'll just share with you, I've been thinking about this in another context, and we could talk about this another time. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, was banned and excommunicated and reviled and attacked because he claimed that he had received visions and had discussions with the Maggid, and the attacks were predicated on the fact that he was too young to receive this kind of revelation, number one. And number two, he was outside the lands of Israel, which sort of says that, you know, in principle, no one objects. I say no one, but let's say no one objects to the notion that one can receive revelation from a Maggid. You just need to check the boxes. You need to be, you know, old enough, holy enough, and in Israel. And as long as that's the case, it seems like it's unobjectionable.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are any other questions, happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I would look forward to seeing everyone, please God, at this time next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks to everybody for being here. Look forward to seeing you all here again next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Bye-bye.